welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we'll be talking a little bit about reproductive justice and how that works together with economic justice, and more about mass incarceration in some of the non-major cities in America. But before we can move on, last night, the first double execution in one day since the year 2000 took place in the state of Arkansas. That's in the United States, that is. Jack Harold Jones died just after 7 o'clock in Arkansas, and Marcel Wayne Williams died 3 hours after, following a rejection of a request by his lawyers for a stay because of the nature of Jones's execution appearing to be somewhat botched. These two deaths are part of the macabre ritual being enacted by the state of Arkansas that was in a rush, or has been in a rush, to kill 11 people in a month before their supply of execution drug midazolam expired. While four of these individuals have received reprieves, it seems, for the rest, including the three already dead, of course, their trip to the death house won't be halted. Arkansas has been front and center of the news on this, as their executions have been case in point regarding issues with lethal injection drugs. The pharmaceutical industry has now turned against providing lethal injection drugs, and states around the country that have the death penalty have been increasingly buying drugs illegally and having compounds made up at super shady pharmacies. This has caused quite a bit of uproar because some of these killer cocktails are created in such a way that the executions are cruel and painful. The legality of the death penalty in the United States has more or less hinged on whether or not it is cruel and unusual punishment. The idea that lethal injection was painless has helped give credence to the idea that it was not cruel or unusual punishment. The growth in the use of midazolam as part of the cocktail, however, has drawn new attention to the issue. Midazolam is a sedative, but as many medical professionals have argued, it doesn't produce enough of a deep, quote-unquote, coma-like state to avoid feeling the pain from the other drugs. Many have described the resulting effect as the chemical equivalent of being burned at the stake. In 2014, Oklahoma's execution of Clayton Lockett was described by the warden of the prison as a, quote, bloody mess. Another witness said it was like a, quote, horror movie. That same year, it took hours for Arizona to execute an inmate using midazolam. And last night in Arkansas, on the murder of Jack Harold Jones, the prison doctor struggled for 45 minutes to put a central line in his neck and failed and had to resort to two IVs. Arkansas's executions have also raised other issues regarding the death penalty, in particular the frequent inadequacy of defense for many convicted prisoners and the mitigating circumstances around mental fitness and childhood histories that, if properly presented, could perhaps have led to the death penalty not having been put on the table. In both of last night's executions, attorneys for the condemned argued that the court had never originally taken into consideration some of these factors. It's worth noting at the outset that both men are convicted of heinous crimes and do not deny they committed them. However, the issue raised by their attorneys, if whether or not death is the appropriate punishment, and that really their crimes are part and parcel of a cycle of violence that began in their youth. Jack Jones, who raped and murdered a bookkeeper and beat her 11-year-old daughter at the same time, that's what he's convicted of, and it's interesting when you look at his backstory, though. He also was abused by his father, abducted and raped by three strangers. He attempted suicide twice before he finally got psychiatric attention. He had committed himself to a hospital for severe depression and suicidal ideation just months before he committed murder, and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder not long before his crime. The jury heard none of that. He also was known to have intense hallucinations and bang his head against cupboards. Again, the jury heard none of that either. Marcel Williams kidnapped, raped, and murdered a 22-year-old mother of two. His attorneys failed to present that starting at age 9, Williams was pimped out by his own mother in exchange for food stamps and a place to stay. He was badly beaten by his mother routinely, including being burned with an electric coil. And when he was once sent to an adult prison as a juvenile, he was raped by adult male prisoners there. Seems fair to ask, in light of all this, whether or not the death penalty really made much sense at all in any of these cases. Our society is deeply violent, and on top of that, we have serious issues of not dealing with mental health issues in this country. You combine these two things with the poverty, hunger, homelessness, and unemployment that stalk tens of millions, it's really not that surprising that many hurt people hurt other people. And is executing those people really a solution? How does that stop this vicious and heinous cycle of violence? Shame on Arkansas and its governor, Asa Hutchinson, for pretending like it does. And as we had reported to you earlier, Sheriff David Clark, Trump's favorite law enforcement officer, presided over a jail where someone died of thirst. Now, the inquest into that death has revealed more interesting information. It turns out the dead man, Terrell Thomas, was kept in solitary confinement for 7 days after jail employees cut off his water supply. Prosecutors in Milwaukee County told a jury that is deciding whether to charge jail officials that this was, quote, highly irregular. Yeah, you don't say. And here's the other thing. Terrell Thomas was not guilty of anything. He was a pretrial detainee. He had been in a mental health crisis, and the response of his jailers was to lock him in a cell for 7 days without any water. He never got his day in court because they murdered him. Let's see if the jury sees fit to hold someone accountable. As we continue our theater of the absurd today, it's worth noting that Saudi Arabia has just been elected to the United Nations Women's Rights Commission. Wow, Saudi Arabia. This is the country where women are banned from driving and need a male guardian to do almost anything outside of their own home. The Saudi monarchy's PR arm made a big show in 2015 when for the first time, women were elected to local councils. They did not, however, make much of a mention of the fact that they were segregated into separate rooms and only allowed to participate via video link. But hey, why not just add them to the UN Commission for Women's Rights? I guess at the very least, they can teach the rest of the world what exactly not to do if they are at all interested in women's rights. Oh, and don't forget, Saudi Arabia is a top five U.S. ally fawned over and praised by Democrats and Republicans alike, with the love sealed in multi-billion-dollar weapons deals. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perger, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And today we're going to be talking about a number of issues swirling around the struggle for reproductive justice, and we are very happy to be joined in this conversation by Jody Jacobson, who is the president and editor-in-chief at Rewire.news. Jody, thank you so much for being with us today.
I appreciate being on the show.
Oh, of course. And so in some ways, I guess I want to slightly bury the lead a little bit here. I think, I don't know, the particulars of the sort of Bernie Sanders, Heath Mello thing I think are important, but I think can really only be approached when you're looking at the context. So anyway, I wanted to start here with this what I think is sort of a key foundational issue in this whole controversy, which is, I mean, is there really some sort of hard wall between quote-unquote reproductive justice and quote-unquote economic justice?
No, there's no hard wall. One is absolutely, they're both intrinsically related. You cannot have, women cannot achieve economic justice. They cannot achieve economic success as a population without the ability to control their fertility, decide whether, when, and with whom to have children. And that is incumbent upon full access to the full range of reproductive health care. Never mind, you know, the health issues around sexually transmitted diseases, you know, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, all those other things, which obviously also play in to reproductive and sexual health care. But the control over fertility is critical for women. And that's something, you know, there are literally decades of data that show this in countries across the world, much of it paid for by the United States Agency for International Development. So there's no dearth of evidence that shows that women cannot attain economic justice without reproductive justice.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think even sort of the term itself, reproductive justice, I mean, speaks to, if I want to use a buzzword, sort of the intersections that which things play out. Because, I mean, it seems like also the access to reproductive health care in terms of region, in terms of, you know, people's access to health insurance and things like that also bears very heavily on issues of both class and race.
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is that reproductive, you know, not to get too technical or split too many hairs, but, you know, access to healthcare is critical for everyone, right? But access in the most like basic term doesn't really mean that you can access it. Just because there is a clinic within 20 miles of your home, let's say, if you can't afford to go to the clinic, if you don't have insurance, if you can't get there transportation wise, you don't really have access to that clinic. So in the same vein, you know, access to reproductive health care is a part of reproductive justice, just like the ability, when we talk about reproductive justice, we're talking about the ability to feed your kids, to educate them, to have the same rights as other people, to live in a safe environment and not be, you know, in a Flint-like situation where your kids are dependent on lead, poisoned water. The full meaning of reproductive justice goes far beyond simply access to care, but that is I would say it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. Nonetheless, they're all kind of intertwined with each other. And one reason that I think, you know, most of the time when we talk about economic growth, we talk about things like per capita income or, you know, aggregate indicators like gross national product or gross domestic product, but that doesn't really tell you regionally and by community which communities are suffering, which communities are left out of that growth. And, you know, the same is true for households. It often doesn't tell you whether there's a disparity between the men and the women in those households or at a per capita level. So what we're talking about here is really digging deep to make sure everybody benefits and that everybody has the tools and the can exercise the rights they need to benefit in a world that's aiming for economic justice. And for women, a big part of that is control over reproduction.
You know, one of the issues in terms of how this often plays out in the political conversation that I think is sort of a factual issue, so I'm wondering if you could sort of enlighten us here, is I think people sort of seem like, oh, well, you know, issues of abortion and access to reproductive health care and so on and so forth, it's like it's popular in California, it's not popular in Mississippi or whatever. So like in California, you know, hold all the candidates to like a really high standard, but in Mississippi, you just have to kind of take what you can get because it's just the context of the situation. And I mean, You hear that sort of argument a lot, but I always wonder if, based on polling and what we know about, you know, how issues play in different places, if it's even true.
It's really not true. I mean, I think there's two, you know, ways to look at that. The first way is I think we have to ask, what do we want from our leaders? And at a very, you know, basic level, what do we want from our leaders? Do we want to, you know, endanger the planet due to climate change based on polling? Or do we want people to go out there and lead and talk about the dangers we face from climate change? And too often we, you know, fall back on polling and what people think, but people often are unfortunately not the best informed. So likewise with abortion care, we rely on polling for something that is a basic human right and should be discussed as such. But there's another aspect to it, which is also that it's a medical issue. It's a public health issue. You can't achieve public health for infants, children, or women who get pregnant if you don't have abortion care available. It's just, again, another proven fact. And finally, because we're so obsessed with this, like, pro-life versus pro-choice dichotomy, we poll in states like Mississippi, let's say, based on things like, are you pro-life or are you pro-choice? And then we draw all kinds of inferences from that. But if you look at the realities of those states, and, you know, I often feel like a broken record about this, but I think it's really instructive. In Mississippi, when a so-called personhood initiative that would have banned abortion and many forms of contraception was put to the ballot, it was resoundingly defeated by, you know, by referendum. People did not want it. So you'd think in Mississippi, which is often considered one of the reddest of the red states, that if people wanted to ban abortion, they would have flocked to the polls to do that. They did not. In fact, they did the opposite. Likewise, in South Dakota, two times bans have been defeated resoundingly. And instead, what the anti-choice movement did was fill the legislatures with money to pay legislators to pass those laws instead over the voices of the people of those states. So even in red states, people who say or self-identify as, quote, pro-life, and frankly, I consider myself pro-life, but for very different reasons, even in those states, you find that people, except for a very small share, don't want to be making those decisions or cutting those decisions off for other people. You know, kind of regular quote is, I can't tell my neighbor what to do. I don't, you know, stand in her shoes. And so it's only, and in fact, the National Right to Life director is famously quoted as having said, we can't get what we want through the democratic process. We're going to have to go through the legislatures. So it's really corrupted in a lot of ways because on one hand, we're, you know, giving human rights and a medical issue over to public opinion. That's very highly misled by the debates that we have. And on the other hand, we're not even allowing people to make those decisions at the state level because there is a very, very vigorous movement to ban all forms of reproductive health care.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, as you brought up that issue of pro-life, I mean, I think in terms of a framing and how we even have the debate, I mean, that seems like sort of a problematic term to, I mean, you know, just, it seems like if you are quote unquote against abortion, that means you're pro-life. That means that abortion is murder, which seems like a huge concession to the sort of argument that's being discussed here.
Yeah. I mean, look, I know people that call themselves pro-life, but they never want to ban abortion and they don't want to make the decision for other people. And to me, that is very different than the political movement that calls itself pro-life, which in fact is not pro-life because they don't vote for healthcare for kids. They are not interested in fixing the problems with lead and water. They are not interested in early childhood education. They vote regularly to, you know, take SNAP benefits away. In Indiana, where our current vice president, who's called himself, you know, the pro-lifeiest of the pro-lifers, he cut all sorts of benefits for women and children. So I contest the whole meaning of so-called pro-life from the professional anti-choice movements. And my take on that movement is it's much more about demographics and getting more people to have white babies than it is about, you know, anything else. That said, you know, I think that there are lots of people who consider themselves, like you said, pro-life, but that's because their personal view is, I wouldn't choose abortion for myself, but I'm not going to tell somebody else what to do. And I've had many people say that to me, and I'm like, well, that I totally respect your decision. Although, you know, again, quite frankly, you never know where you're going to end up in your life. I've also had many stories told to me by women who ended up with, you know, pregnancies gone dramatically awry, and they found themselves having to face an abortion. And they would say, I never thought I would be in that position, and now I never want anybody else to be denied that service. So it's a very complicated issue, and we try to boil it down to this binary,
right,
and it really doesn't work that way.
Absolutely. Well, we are going to take a break here. We're going to be back with more with Jody Jacobson here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing our conversation about some of the ways reproductive justice is swirling around in our political, social, cultural, and economic sphere. And we're continuing to be joined here by Jody Jacobson, who's the president and editor-in-chief at Rewire.news. And, you know, I think that's a good point that we left off on there, Jody, about people's sort of personal beliefs versus their, you know, what they're sort of willing to – how they relate to the issue politically. I mean, I'm somewhat curious about the way you feel this plays out with politicians, though, because I often find I call it sort of like the Tim Kaine conundrum, as you were, sort of the I'm personally pro-life, but I support choice, blah, blah, blah. But I feel like a lot of times you drill down, and when that's, to me, almost like a red flag, and a lot of times it may not be, you know, whatever, the people are out there saying, well, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, but then on the other hand, you know, they're sort of nipping around the edges of different pieces to perhaps, you know, make themselves look more viable to a different political constituency. So it also seems like in the political sphere, that whole sort of I'm personally pro-life, but has its own kind of sort of hidden meaning.
I think this issue is so hard to figure out because it's so stigmatized and it's so there's so much religious, I don't want to call it rhetoric, but, you know, like sort of religious stigma around this as well. You know, in this country, as well as everywhere else in the world, Catholic women have abortions at the same rates as women of any other faith. Evangelical women have abortions at the same rates as women of any other faith. People have abortions. They always, you know, you will listen to clinic directors tell you stories of, you know, one day the protester's out there screaming and the next day she's in having an abortion. But her abortion, she'll say, is different because she's not a slut or she's special or this is a special situation. So it's, we are so, you know, generally speaking, we're so screwed up about sex in this country, never mind abortion, that that we can't have honest conversations about these things. But the reality is that I don't really care what someone calls themselves as long as they're not trying to impose their religious beliefs on others. Likewise, not imposing their religious beliefs or misrepresentations on LGBTQ people or on what hospital care can be provided. I just think religion does not belong in medicine and or in public health, and certainly not in human rights. And so I think you can distinguish between someone saying, I'm pro-life, but I'm not out there, you know, I'm also pro-choice and that I want to make sure that women are not robbed of this choice. I have no problem with that. I have a real problem when people are, in fact, trying to shape the access to care that people get.
Mm-hmm. You know, one sort of subsidiary issue here that I think is interesting when you raise the issue, the importance, I think, of, or I think it's the importance of having candidates who are willing to lead on issues. I mean, certainly something I'm slightly more familiar with is in sort of the wake of the last election, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, how people coming out of the black community are being picked and groomed and brought forward as candidates, you know, people coming out of the movement for black lives and sort of new leadership emerging and there being somewhat of a disconnect in terms of some of the traditional political structures and organizations and some of the new sort of energy on the street. So I also wonder in issues like this, if there's also kind of a subsidiary issue that we're speaking to here, that there are not enough women and girls, certainly women and girls of color, who are really being sort of, you know, promoted, brought forward, you know, given the training, sort of the platform to come up and come forward as leaders. And so then at the end of the day, you know, you're just sort of left with whoever you're left with in a lot of races around the country on a range of issues. But certainly, I don't know, at least in one sector, it seems like a problem. So I don't know if you think here that's also
I think it's a huge problem. I mean, look, you know, let's not to diss anybody, but let's look at the current races that we have in a way. Okay, Montana, you can kind of get it. There's a guy who's a country singer. I'm not dissing him. I hope he wins. But, you know, but then, you know, you've got Ossoff in Georgia and yeah, Kansas and Omaha are pretty white. But most of the people that we're talking about here today are, you know, mainstream white guys. And where are the women? Where are the women of color? Where are the Latino women? You know, we are still at a place where women haven't even achieved like 30% representation, never mind half, and they're more than half of the population. And, you know, women of color, for example, literally hold up the Democratic Party. And yet, again, they are grossly underrepresented and their needs are grossly underrepresented. But yet, you know, without women of color, you wouldn't have had McAuliffe as governor in Virginia, just as one example. So, you know, I think that it's just odd to me that we are not out there seeking out powerful progressive candidates of, you know, of distinction from across a wide variety of personal circumstances, races, you know, what have you, and making our slate really powerful by having people who stand up for what they believe. And all the data shows that really people are motivated, even if they disagree with you, by someone with guts, someone who says, this is what I believe, this is why I believe it, here's, you know, where I'm going to disagree with you, but I'm going to do so honestly, and, you know, but here's where I'm going to agree with you because we definitely agree on that. And people admire that, and they will vote for that. I think the Democrats continue to lose because they are so continuously white and also because they are so, even though the Democratic, you know, population isn't, but also because they are so unwilling to really live by the values they say they espouse.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's a good point. I mean, to me, it's one of the, sort of the bigger frustrations about any time these conversations crop up about the way – I don't even really necessarily like to use this term, quote-unquote, diversity pops up in terms of the progressive movement. And people say, well, we need a broad progressive movement. But I always think that why is broad defined as including, you know, more conservative – of like a really narrow subset of more conservative white people? Like why is broad not like young, black, queer, women? You know what I'm saying? It seems like a weird thing.
Exactly. No, I totally agree with you. I just think that we are not doing a very good job of recruiting and cultivating people who represent the actual population at hand and who can bring different things to the party. And also, I totally agree with you. I'm constantly amazed at how many amazing people I know and how few amazing people I see getting into politics. But, you know, maybe that's changing now, and I do think there's some of it that's changing with respect to how many people have signed up to run for office and, you know, the sort of anger post-Trump that has become that has driven so much of the resistance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now, speaking of candidates, races, and the like, let me try to cut right to the heart of the matter here. I'll start with Tom Perez, since he has sort of aggressively walked his statements back. I mean, how did you feel about how he, you know, I mean, I guess on the one hand, you come under fire and you recognize criticism and embrace it, I guess, you know, to some degree. Hard to knock that. But I don't know. I mean, it just struck me as so cynical that, like, one day you have one position and the next day you're like, no, I have the exact opposite position. And, you know, we should never do anything the same. But it sort of makes me think, say Heath Mello wins in a big blowout win. I mean, how much confidence can someone have that they're not going to say, well, hey, maybe our original point was the right point?
Well, here's the thing. And, you know, put this caveat in that I know Tom personally and know him to be a really terrific person, but I think that he was strategically, I mean, my first thought was, have you been, you know, absent from school since the ACA fights? I mean, the fights around contraception, the fights around abortion, the fights around, you know, 20-week abortion bans across the country. Where have you been? How could you not have seen this coming? How could you not know that and be the leader of the DNC? That was my first thought. How did you not talk to women's groups first? So I thought it was an extremely bad kind of foray into this issue to come out with a statement that effectively smacked women down. And then, of course, when, you know, you're confronted by two of the biggest reproductive rights PACs, NARAL and Planned Parenthood, then you change your tune because you need them to win races. So that, to me, was all a very obvious and unfortunate, sort of drama that played out. But I think it speaks to the fact that too many Democrats, and especially men, again, and also let's throw in Bernie here because he's not a Democrat, he says, but whatever, they still don't get that this is a fundamental issue of justice and of public health and of medicine. They still do not get that. So you could never imagine, or at least I can't imagine, let's say, Tom or Bernie or someone excusing a law that says, let's make black people prove they can read before they can go and vote, and let's make sure that they have extra steps they have to take and get counseling before they get an ID. I mean, in this day and age, of course, there are some people in our government, unfortunately, that probably would, like, propose that. But in this day and age, the Democrats would be aghast. They'd be, like, aghast. But when it comes to saying, oh, we're going to put women through all of these shaming exercises, and we're going to tell them that they have to look at this image and they have to do that, and, oh, God, did you know you were pregnant? And, you know, and then make them go through all these hoops, we call that a big tent. It's just, it's really, it's so dismissive at such a profoundly fundamental level that in a way that the Democrats, you know, of course the Republicans dismiss all of this, but the Democrats are supposed to not, and they still do. And that's what gets me, is that they remain blind, and I keep asking myself, where have you been the past 8 or 10 years when we've been saying over and over, we've been putting out the papers on the economic issues around abortion care. We've been putting out the papers around how denial of abortion care makes women poorer. I mean, where have you been? If you're going to lead a party, where have you been?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good point. And I mean, to me, it was just the whole thing in the first place. It struck me right away as something of a double standard because, I mean, to some degree, the lesson just of 2016, I mean, I think both Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders came under a lot of, I would say, pretty righteous critique from the Movement for Black Lives. Both candidates then sort of started to embrace more of the criticisms that were put towards it. And then the whole thing was sort of spun as like, whether people thought their responses or changes were cynical or whatever, the whole thing was spun as like, yeah, you know, you got to get up there and challenge people on the important priorities if you really want them to move on them. And here, to me, seems like a textbook example of the exact same type of thing. Like, women rising up and be like, whoa, this is completely ridiculous. But the response, I guess it's not that hard to believe that it happened, but it does sort of seem, you know, I don't know. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I'm of the mind, and I always say this, I am not a candidate person. I'm an issue person. So I don't care if you're Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, or the Green Spaghetti Monster. If you don't have the right position, I'm going to criticize you because I'm all about the evidence and about human rights. And I think any politician, no matter who you are, should be held accountable. If I were in office, I would expect to be held accountable. But so I don't have any problem with, you know, advocating for people. But it just gets to a point where you feel like, okay, you know the women are running the resistance. You know that women are more than 50% of the population. You know that women basically hold up the Democratic Party. And you don't know the most foundational things. You don't understand the most foundational things. And you can be so, you know, yeah, the advocacy is fine, but I think at a certain point you feel like you shouldn't have to do that kind of advocacy, just like I feel like people shouldn't have to do race advocacy with Bernie. I mean, it's just kind of like, what gives here, you know?
Look right, around it's 2017.
Yourself, guys. Yeah, I mean, so that's where, you know.
Yeah, the way it falls for it. You know, and one thing I also want to try to clear up too here is in regards to Heath Mello himself, I honestly got slightly confused because it seemed like there was some fudging there where then all of a sudden people tried to say, well, no, you know, it wasn't what people were saying wasn't what it was. And he was trying to stop some other bill that was bad. And he had 100% rating from Planned Parenthood. I mean, what is his record on choice issues?
Okay. So first thing is he co-sponsored one of the first 20-week abortion bans in the nation. North Carolina had the very first, but Nebraska had the first one that was based on completely medically disproven so-called fetal pain, and he co-sponsored that bill. So he co-sponsored an abortion ban, and that ban passed and was signed by the governor. Then he co-sponsored a bill that eliminated telemedicine abortion. So in other words, in a rural state, when a woman finds out she's pregnant, she's still able to get a medication abortion by which you have a certain combination of birth control at a certain level that you can take to induce an abortion. And it's perfectly safe. It's been proven safe, you know, time and time again. You can do that through telemedicine. But because they eliminated telemedicine, you're not allowed to have telemedicine abortion, which makes it very hard for rural women in Nebraska to get access to abortion because, you know, then you've got to get to a city and you've got to go through all the rigmarole of waiting periods and all this other stuff. And it makes it that much more expensive and that much harder because of childcare, overnight stays, and all the rest. Then there was a bill that did several things. First, the bill had in it plainly in the language a mandatory ultrasound, and it had a lot of other stuff in it. And frankly, you know, the other stuff, I think, as I've read these bills, is worse than just the ultrasound part. Because the second bill, which people claim Mello made better, is actually a worse bill than the first bill. It leaves, it has language in there criminalizing abortion and allowing for the arrest of women. It has other language in there that does other things that are really bad. And it makes very vague what's supposed to happen with an ultrasound. So, for example, it says that you must determine the gestational age. But it also says that only a doctor not a physician's assistant or a nurse or whatever may carry out these things. So by the time you get to the level of the doctor, you are talking ultrasound and you are talking about a script that they've got to tell her about all these bad things about abortion. And then you have to give her a list of all the free places you can get an ultrasound, which include all the crisis pregnancy centers where they mislead and lie to you. So the whole ultrasound thing, I think in some way has been blown up in the context of all the bad things that bill does. But there's nothing good about that bill, and I'm not really sure why people think it's such a credit to him because he co-sponsored it. So I'm a little bit confused my own self about why people think that bill was like supposed to be the saving grace. Never mind the 20-week abortion ban and all the rest of it.
Mm. Wow. I mean, it really, yeah, it just seems like this is unambiguous. I mean, this is not even like, you know, he just touched around the edges. I mean, he seems to have been like sort of knee deep in a lot of these terrible bills. I mean, it really is just shocking to me. And you know, turning to Bernie Sanders, I have to say, I've been positive, negative, different things. I try to be, you know, very issue-based. I agree with you. But it just sort of seemed to me that then they have the Our Revolution thing on Saturday or whatever day it was this past weekend where then there's three separate speakers get up and are like, yeah, you know, women's rights, we, you know, can't go backward, blah, 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 blah. And I just found myself thinking, you've got to be joking. I mean, like, this is not even, I mean, this, I mean, this is even more, it was almost like a double down slap in the face. Like, oh, you didn't like what we did? Well, not only are we going to not apologize, but then we're going to now speak to your critique in some ways without ever even acknowledging you exist. And that to me was like, wow, that maybe is why they're in this conundrum in the first place.
I would have to agree. Others have said, you know, like, for example, with Bernie, others have said he's got a great economic message, but he's not the right messenger for the holistic view of it because he's not very good on race and gender and in some other areas. And I would tend to agree. I mean, I think that probably an Elizabeth Warren would be better than he would in getting out there and doing those things. But nonetheless, she'd also have to be held accountable. I think no matter who the politician is, you know, it's kind of like, was it FDR that said?
To make me do a thing?
Johnson. Yeah, the make
that
me
is
do
FDR.
Thing.
You're right.
FDR. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, and like kind of that's what politics is about, right? Make me do it. I mean, I think Obama was even saying that at some point. You got to get out there and, you know, and generate grassroots pressure. And I think we don't do enough of that. I think we fall into these camps where you're a Bernie person, you're a Hillary person. I mean, the fights about that are still going on are just exhausting. Whereas I feel like, okay, what do we want from these people and how are we going to get it?
Right.
And I don't care who you are. You know, you need to be pushed in the right way.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. We're going to have to leave it there for today before we take our next break. But thank you so much to Jody Jacobson, Rewire.news. That is required reading here at By Any Means Necessary. So please check out all the work they do here. We're going to come back with one more segment here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about how mass incarceration affects some of the smaller cities, towns, counties in America. And we are very happy to be joined again on the show by Professor James Kilgore, who's an activist, writer, and educator. He's based in Urbana, Illinois. He's got a novel that was out recently, Sister Mercy's Revenge, which is a crime fiction piece set in a California prison. I say definitely check that out. And in the nonfiction world, he's also the author of Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. Professor Kilgore, thank you so much for being with us again.
It's great to be with you, Eugene. How are you doing today?
You know, I'm doing pretty well. I can't complain. So I wanted to start the conversation with just, a little framing here. I mean, you know, we talk on the show all the time about mass incarceration, primarily in relationship to major cities. But you and then some others I know have been doing some work about how it really is impacting some of the smaller towns and rural areas. And you wrote an article fairly recently for Truth Out using your home area there of Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, to kind of contextualize a lot of this. And I was pretty surprised to see in there, I mean, intense rates of segregation in a lot of different ways and an arrest rate that seems to rival Ferguson, yet this is all in a so-called liberal college town.
That's right. I think there's a trend in small communities to increase incarceration, increased jail building, and our county, which is the highlight of our county, or the centerpiece of our county, is this flagship campus of the University of Illinois, which has 44,000 students in a county of 200,000. And yet the university, which is a sort of bastion of liberalism, remains pretty well separate from the rest of the community. But I've been involved for the past 5 years with a group called Build Programs Not Jails, and we've been contesting the county authorities' attempts to build a jail or to build new jail cells in the county, spending about $20 to $30 million, which is a lot of money in a small county. And part of our motivation for doing this is the fact that our jail population is now around 65 to 70% black in a county that's 13% black. And if you track the racial disparities, particularly in areas across the Midwest, you find similar patterns. And you'll find also that in many counties, there's a push to expand jails, build new jails, or build new facilities inside of jails, which occupy a considerable portion of local revenues.
I mean, interesting piece. And before we move on, I'm just sort of curious to sort of get some of this history out of the way as well. I mean, I'm curious, you know, what's some of the history of the Urbana-Champaign area with segregation and things like that? I mean, I've often heard about the state of Illinois, is that like you have Chicago and the rest of the state is Mississippi. So I'm sort of curious just historically how a lot of the sort of racial tensions, you know, that many people know about generally have played out in that area.
Well, I mean, southern and central Illinois was the home to many sundown towns, which are towns where basically black people were not allowed within the city limits after sundown. Now, Urbana-Champaign was one of those, but it's surrounded by some towns that were. So there's kind of an infusion of that ideology into the local community. So historically, the university has capitulated to that kind of racism for quite some time. And it was only really in the late 1960s when black and brown students did a major occupation of buildings on campus that they began to desegregate and they began to really look at increasing enrollments of students of color. But even now, the black enrollment, for example, at the University of Illinois is only about 4.5%, which is far less than the 15% black population in the state as a whole. And there's an ironically named street called University Avenue, which is really the dividing line between the university campus and the predominantly black north end of Champaign, where we have a very different regimes of policing. Of course, we know that university campuses are hotbeds of drug activity, but the police don't worry too much about the fraternities and sororities. But north of University Avenue, this is where we have intense policing. And this has essentially been ignored by the university authorities. They don't really get involved in any of the local issues around criminal justice.
Well, and you know, in terms of the policing issue as well, one of the things that really caught my eye in your piece is that sometimes the police there are using MRAPs, the mine resistant vehicles, which was just, I mean, on the one hand, shocking to me, but it did remind me of when I was in Baltimore after the uprising, how one of the most striking things to me was seeing all these like little tiny small towns of like, you'd look them up, 10,000 people, but then they've got these police units that are in Baltimore there that look like they're the Navy SEALs or something like that. So I would assume that sort of a similar sort of militarization aspect there in Urbana.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the sheriff got the MRAP a couple years back from the federal program of giving out goodies to local sheriffs. And, you know, I mean, it's not used every day, but it's definitely a presence. It's definitely seen in the North End in some of these drug raids. And our county also has a drone, which there seems to be a lot of mystery about what that's used for because it hasn't been very transparent. But so there has certainly been a militarization of police, and we've had a number of incidences of vicious beatings and one police killing in 2009 of a black youth named Kwan Carrington, which prompted a lot of resistance within the community. So there has been a lot of mobilization around policing and also around the conditions in the jail, because from December of 2015 to the middle of last year, we had three deaths in the jail, all of them black people, all of them connected to some kind of substance abuse, stroke, mental health issues that weren't addressed when these people were admitted into the jail.
Well, I mean, it certainly seems like a big piece. And I know that you work on reentry as well as there, and I'm curious if there's a similar trend as things that I've seen certainly in Washington and other places of those who formerly incarcerated people really starting to get way more organized in terms of fighting for their human rights.
That's right. I'm a co-director of a reentry program called First Followers. You know, we believe that reentry should be led by people who have been critically impacted by mass incarceration, especially those who have been locked up. So we've been around for about 2 years now. I mean, we've started out doing basic things like helping people get IDs, helping people get jobs, but we've intentionally begun to expand our role to much more of an advocacy political mobilization role. So, for example, last year we went into the parks for events during the summer that were largely focused on the black community, and we did surveys of people about their knowledge on what challenges people coming home from prison faced and what could be done about it. And we found, of course, that about 80% of the people that we approached at these events had either been incarcerated themselves or had a loved one incarcerated, and virtually all of them, you know, recognize the challenges that people have in terms of finding employment, finding housing, and so forth. So we've been now processing those results, and we've been taking them around to the city council, to the university community, to community organizations in the black community, and trying to conscientize the population about the fact that this is a problem and it needs action, it needs transitional housing, it needs resources to be provided to people who are coming home from prison. So this has been a real, I think, empowering exercise for the people that have been part of our program in terms of actually conducting research and then beginning to speak out as the authorities on these issues in our local community.
And I'm curious if there is any sort of particularistic challenges in terms of, like, at least the employment aspect of reentry to being in sort of these maybe smaller areas, more rural areas in the Midwest, whether the deindustrialization, the family farmer crisis, different pieces like that, if that adds sort of a different layer of challenge as well for people coming out and looking to find a place where they're gainfully employed or able to be.
I think that is a problem in many places. It's not quite as critical in Champaign-Urbana because there actually is some economic growth in Champaign-Urbana. There's a lot of kind of research-connected industries moving in, and there is factory production that's come online in recent years. So in terms of opportunities for employment, that's not so difficult. What's more difficult is getting past the hurdles of having felony convictions and criminal background. So, I mean, as First Followers, we've been actually, you know, making calls and visits to employers and trying to talk to them about the issues of people with criminal backgrounds and trying to open up some doors. We've had some luck, but there's still an awful lot of stigma, an awful lot of fear about, you know, what if I employ a murderer or a rapist and something happens? How am I going to deal with my customers? Blah, blah, that kind of stuff. But we're trying to change that environment. But in other places, certainly Chicago, but places like Peoria, places like Decatur, which had a lot of industry that has since gone, it becomes much more difficult for people to find work.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I'm also curious about as well is, and I'm always, as someone who's from a college town, I'm always very interested in sort of how the K-12 schools are working in different college towns. I mean, how much is the school-to-prison pipeline an issue there?
The school-to-prison pipeline is definitely an issue. There's been a lot of mobilization, particularly in the black community, around the issue of police in schools, you know, student resource officers. I mean, they haven't managed to get them out of there, but there's been a lot of opposition to that. There's also clear-cut statistics that black students are have far higher rates of expulsion and suspension, far lower graduation rates and so forth. So there's quite a bit of mobilization amongst parents in the community around these issues. I don't think we have the kind of militarized schools that we might see in inner cities, but certainly the level of policing and the kind of policing mentality in schools is something that we would have never seen, say, 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very, very true. And in terms of changes over time, one of the pieces in your article that sort of struck me was the one gentleman who had mentioned that at one point, you know, when he would go visit once a year, family in prison, they'd have these big picnics inside of prison, something that they certainly ended. I mean, it really just thought, to me, it really struck me. I thought it was a profound statement about how this whole obsession with the prisons appearing, you know, quote unquote, tough or whatever, has not only had a negative impact on prisoners and their families, but I just felt like ending something like that can't possibly be in any way, shape, or form helpful around, you know, any sort of like quote-unquote rehabilitation or whatever people want to call it. But I'm curious your thoughts about that.
Well, I mean, these are not budgetary issues. These are issues of just wanting to get tough and stop those connections. And I mean, Illinois has a policy which I think is unique in the country, and that is that if you are in prison and you're ready and you've finished your sentence and you're ready to go out on parole, if you don't have a place to live, you won't be released. You'll serve your parole in prison. Mm. So this, I've just had an email from someone whose son is getting ready to be released, and his mother lives in Section 8 housing in government housing, and Section 8 housing in Champaign-Urbana does not permit people with felony convictions unless they've been out off parole for more than 5 years to live there. Plus, she's willing to have him live, but they won't allow him to live there because the sister has dogs that are not spayed or neutered, and they won't allow somebody to live in a house with a dog that's not spayed or neutered. So this guy faces the prospect of spending another 2 or 3 years in prison because he doesn't have a place to go and live in the community. And I mean, the flip side of that is that people often, their family members or their former partners and so forth, accept them into the house in a situation that's completely untenable, either economically or emotionally, simply because they don't want to see this person do another 3 years in prison. So we have a kind of a recipe for domestic conflict when we have somebody coming home, moving in with a former partner who might be a mother of their children, but is also living with their present partner now in a very small space, and it's just a recipe for disaster, and it's completely inexplicable. And in our community, it's been made even worse by the fact in the last year they've closed both of the major shelters for homeless people in this community, so that's no longer an option for people coming home from prison either.
Wow, well, that's crazy. So dogs aren't spayed and neutered. I mean, I just can't even believe that. I mean, wow. I mean, it just seems like they're just like, that's a big issue in terms of both reentry and prison, and just the whole system is just these arbitrary things. Like, I remember there was one young woman in your story who said that if she like made a friend that the Child and Family Services was doing criminal background checks on the parents of her potential friends. I mean, that just seems like, I mean, outrageous. I have no idea what the criminal background is of, you know, my friends growing up. Well, I mean, I know some of them, but you know what I'm saying? It's not as if that's the key determinant of whether or not, you know, it was a good friendship. I mean, it just seems like an unbelievable set of hurdles and things we just throw out there.
Right. And I mean, the additional thing that Illinois has added in the last year or so is they tend to be putting most people who come out of prison onto parole onto an electronic monitor, and they're only allowed out of the house 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for 4 hours. So that creates all kinds of, you know, domestic tension, but it also incredibly limits their ability to go out and look for work or to connect up with the community in any way. And for example, in our reentry program, we run a drop-in center on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so none of these people that are coming out on parole that are on the monitor that can only come out Monday, Wednesday, and Friday can come to our drop-in center unless they apply for special permission to get movement on those days. So there's just all kinds of ways in which people are set up to be frustrated, set up up to do something foolish that's going to end up putting them back into the system.
I mean, is it fair to say that some of that is on purpose, too, that, like, it's not just like an accident that we don't have, like, a great reentry system in America?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think historically, as mass incarceration has grown, we have seen that increasingly parole has been made into a setup. So in the old days, you know, back in the in early 1980s or something, I mean, parole officers were seen to be kind of akin to social workers. And I can remember people that I was in prison with saying that when they were in prison, they did a welding certificate. And when they got out, their parole officer gave them a welding equipment in order to enable them to start their own business. Now, today, When a parole agent walks into your house, they're packing a 9mm. They're not bringing you gifts. They're packing a 9mm. They're there to scare you. I mean, they've become police. They're about control. They ride around in many communities. They ride around with police looking for their charges to be hanging out in the wrong place. So the whole parole system has been set up to get people back into prison, back into jail, and keep the population growing. It's self-serving, and obviously it keeps those jobs growing as well. So and only now, when we've seen some awareness of mass incarceration, we're starting to see some decline in, like, technical violations in some states where people are no longer sent back to prison because they miss an appointment with their parole officer, or they don't tell them when they move, or something like that. But there's still a whole lot of technical violations we've seen. I mean, just yesterday, Eli Hager of the Marshall Report did a survey of people who are in prison because of technical parole violations nationally. He found something like 61,000 people, but there's bound to be lots more that he didn't find.
Wow. I mean, that's it really just on every single level, it seems like there's not that much out there. But you do have at the end of the piece that a lot of people, and you've referenced this a couple times throughout our interview here today, people are fighting back there. So it isn't as if this is just a dark night on all sides.
I think that's totally true. And I think the struggles in small towns are not really on the radar. But I remember about 2 years ago, I did a Skype session with a community group in Lawrence, Kansas, and they said, and I just talked a little bit about mass incarceration and all these kinds of things. And I asked, okay, so what's happening in your community? They said, well, we've been fighting against a jail. And I said, oh, really? So, do you have meetings and stuff? What does your organization look like? And they said, oh yeah, we had a meeting last week about this, quite a big meeting. I said, oh, a big meeting? How big? They said, 1,700 people. I went, what? You got to be kidding me. In Lawrence, Kansas, you have 1,700 people coming out around an issue of a jail. But I mean, these things are like not on the radar at all. But I've talked to a lot of people in small towns who are engaged in struggles against jails and a whole range of criminal justice related issues that, we hear about New York, we hear about D.C., we hear about California, and we do hear about Chicago. But beyond that, there's a whole lot of dots on the map where there's a lot of things happening. And I get quite a few calls from people in different parts of the country that are doing work around jails just to kind of, share ideas about strategies for fighting these small town jails, which tend to be a slightly different terrain of struggle because we live in small towns that tend to be majority white populations with disparate populations in terms of those incarcerated. So it's a little bit different structure of mobilization and campaigning than we find in major cities.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much to Professor James Kilgore for joining us here for that interview. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.